Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today, my guest is Dorian Yates, and we're going to be talking about two of her green earth guides, Traveling Naturally in Spain and Traveling Naturally in France. For those of you that are well-traveled, you fully understand how difficult it can be at times to get specific types of food, especially if you have different sensitivities or if you truly are looking for foods grown organically, and in some cases if you need gluten-free and especially vegan. The guides that are on the internet are wonderful, but what happens when you don't have cell phone access or internet access? I mean, that does happen from time to time. It's happened to me. And when you are traveling, there's so many different things that you could be missing out on that don't necessarily have to cost a lot of money, but you won't necessarily find out about unless you actually speak to somebody who has similar interests and really understands the needs that you may have. In the Green Earth Guides, you'll find all sorts of information ranging from restaurants to hotels, just different accommodations, and it's just a really wonderful collection of information you really need to know, especially if you're traveling in these two countries. So I would like to welcome to the show Dorian Yates. Good afternoon, Dorian, and welcome to the show.
Thanks, June. Great to be on.
Dorian, what made you decide to write the Green Earth Guides?
Well, honestly, I travel a bit, and when I travel, these are the sorts of things I seek out. It's just because I'm interested in them in terms of food. It's the way I like to eat. And one day I was actually traveling in Switzerland, and I was chatting with somebody that I met on a trail, and they were asking me if I happened to know of any health food stores, and I was able to rattle off a bunch in this nice small city of St. Gallen. And they said, that's great. You should write a guide. And the light bulb went off in my head. Wow, you know, I do this for fun when I travel. That's my idea of a fun itinerary, is to scope out where the markets are, where the health food stores are, where other things of environmental consciousness are. And so I started with France, and then did Spain, and I actually have also done Switzerland and now have gotten into apps, but it's just a passion of mine.
Well, it's a passion of yours that is so incredibly needed, and I do believe you have a number of guides that you need to write, especially for the United States. It's interesting. We're so dependent upon the internet, and when you're traveling, you don't always have internet connectivity. You don't always have cell phone connectivity. I know that I've had that very experience when I went to China, when I went to Austria. I've traveled quite extensively, and you can't always depend upon the internet to be there for you. And the thing is that especially when you are traveling, your time is so incredibly valuable because you don't have an abundance of time that you could just wander around and waste. I mean, unless that's something that you choose. I know when I am traveling, I try to make the most of my time, and I also try to find the most unique things to do that will not only make my experience memorable, but enjoyable. Because the last thing that you want to do is go to a restaurant that you've never heard of, especially in a foreign country where you don't speak the language, and then lo and behold, you wind up being sick for the next few days because you didn't know that the restaurant that you went to basically had a very poor reputation, and there's really no way of knowing that until, unfortunately, after it happened. So when you have guides such as the Green Earth Guide, it's just wonderful to be able to learn firsthand, okay, here are the areas, this is what you can expect to find, and it's just such a perfect time for this.
Well, I must say that, you know, certainly in the realm of anything sort of a non-mainstream diet, whether you have a gluten problem or whether you're vegan or vegetarian, you know, you have trouble with certain kinds of dairy, you know, whatever it is, and more people are finding that they have either problems such as, you know, allergies or sensitivities, or just are making philosophical decisions based on health or belief systems about what they choose to eat. And it's really hard to find that information, even if you do have information. I mean, even if you do have access to the Internet, that can be really hard. If you're in a foreign country and you're getting information, either it's the foreign websites that, you know, are not yet translated into English, or you're getting English websites based on not somebody being on the ground, but some sort of general whatever it is. I don't even know how they do that, you know, kind of scrape the website for places near you without any qualification. But I know in Spain, for instance, Spaniards love to boast that they use every part of the pig, which is actually very ecological. And if you are a meat eater, you know, you can partake of that. But if you're not, I mean, I have to say, when I was traveling in Spain, I can't tell you how many times Spaniards would say to me, "What do you mean you're a vegetarian?" They just didn't even comprehend it. And then they might get it. It's sort of like that joke, "Oh, you're vegetarian. That's great. Here's some pig meat." You know, they just don't even understand what that really means. Obviously, some do. But it's just information that can be hard to track down, even if you were just sort of stopping somebody on the street and saying, "Where's a vegetarian restaurant?"
What I found to be kind of an all-purpose reason for requesting a specific food requirement, if you will, as far as vegetarian and vegan, is I just say very nicely, I have very bad allergies, and that usually shuts
mm-hmm.
them up.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Unfortunately, it's just, it hasn't quite evolved around the globe at this point, but the one thing that I think is very interesting is that depending upon the region that you're in, each region has its own specialty. And once again, some of these specialties, especially if you don't speak the language, it's very difficult to communicate the fact that you don't want something that's been cooked in a beef broth, especially
right.
if you have a beef allergy or you're a vegan.
Right. Exactly. You know, the other thing is, I obviously in France, people always, you know, rave about French food. But in Spain, it's very interesting. I've heard a number of people who visit Spain and say, "Wow, I just thought the food was horrible in Spain." And Spain has some of the most remarkable food. And it's fresh, and it's just magnificent. But you have to know where to find it. You know, you have to be able to, you know, either know where the restaurants are that serve that good food or know where the markets are to go get it. I mean, they have beautiful, cheap food in Spain. So I feel badly for people who have gone to Spain and have had terrible food experiences, because there's just magnificent food there.
And I think it also helps to understand the foods that are available, that, you know, the foods that are part of the culture. For example, with tapas, it is a part of their culture, and you can find some amazing tapas bars that have vegetarian dishes. I mean,
absolutely.
Basically, you're talking about something that's added to a slice of bread and served
right.
with liquor. And, you know, the bottom line is that it could be an olive tapenade. It could be all sorts of different things, maybe even grilled vegetables.
Grilled vegetables, absolutely. Yep.
One of the most popular tapas recipes is with figs with cheese. And if you're vegan, that's not something that you're going to resonate towards. But if you're vegetarian, you know, it's a great way to go.
Exactly.
Not everything has to have meat on it. And some of them, especially if you're ordering tapas, you can get food that has that you can actually see the meat, and you can just physically remove it if you'd like to.
Exactly. Exactly. The other thing is, it's important to note that, you know, at least up until now, I don't know what will happen in the future, agriculture is pretty different in Europe than it is in the United States. There are a number of countries that don't allow genetically modified organisms.
Yes.
There are countries like France and Switzerland and Germany that have very, very strong organic farming standards and lots of organic farms and vineyards. In terms of certainly the Mediterranean countries, cows are really not a big thing there. You know, there are a lot of sheep and goat cheeses available that are much more common than they are here. And so there's a whole different culture around food, what food means, what fresh food is, where you get it, how you get it, and how it's produced. That's not to say that there's not some awful stuff over there, but there is a different mindset around food and agriculture than there is in the United States.
Well, let me ask you a question. When it comes to more specialty foods, especially gluten-free, how popular is that over in France and Spain? I mean, is it very difficult to get gluten-free foods?
Interestingly enough, and I was never able to get to the bottom of this, in Spain, there are gluten-free foods everywhere. I can only imagine that somebody in the government or a member of the royal family has gluten intolerance because gluten-free food is very available, even in the big supermarkets. And bear in mind that in Spain, there's certainly pasta dishes, but they gravitate a little bit more towards rice. It just in general, even if they're not specializing in gluten-free, and potatoes and vegetables. And so it's very easy in Spain. You know, paella is huge, and that's a rice-based dish. So it's very easy in Spain to find intentionally gluten-free products as well as unintentional, but just sort of because of the nature of the dishes they like, gluten-free foods. France is a little different, home of the best baguettes in the world, you know, amazing French bakeries. And while there is gluten-free, it is not prevalent the way it is in Spain. I would say intentional gluten-free is definitely relegated to, you know, the health food stores. And in terms of dining out, though, again, you have many options. You know, it's not just like everything's thrown on a plate of pasta or anything like that. It has a much more sensitivity just to food preparation and variety in foods and all of that, I think, too, much more than in the United States, at least in terms of mainstream eating. So where you really run into hardship in France is just that both the culture and part of the experience is there is, you know, every block there's some amazing bakery, and they're not gluten-free bakeries. They are, you know, magnificent bakeries spewing out divine gluten-rich breads and pastries. That said, I do know people, this would not obviously apply to people with celiac disease, but people who have gluten intolerance or sensitivities, there are people who I speak with who can manage some French wheat products. That's not to say that they could live on them 365 days of the year, but so I chalk that up to the fact that they're using a different wheat, one that maybe has not been hybridized to be quite as rich in gluten as some of the wheat in the United States.
Thank you. Now, on the topic of food, what if you're traveling with your animal companion, with your dog, possibly your cat? There's some people that take birds, but primarily with your dog. Say if you're traveling with your dog, what are accommodations like for dogs, even with food? I mean, is it difficult to find good food for your dog? I would never give my dog canned food to begin with, but I mean, have you been able to explore any options as far as pets?
Yeah, that's definitely a little tougher. You know, again, some of the health food stores will carry, you know, sort of higher quality specialty animal food products. but you don't really see, I mean, in this country, you there's a burgeoning market of, you know, specialty, high-quality pet foods. And I have not seen that in Europe yet. That's not to say it's not coming, but I have not seen that. So somebody would really have to do a little advanced homework. I mean, obviously, you don't want to have to carry a whole suitcase with dog food with you, if you can avoid that. And again, which country you go to, I would say in Spain you'd be much, that would be much more difficult to find than in France. In France, you would have better luck at, France, something that's interestingly very different between the two countries, even though they're neighbors, is France has, you know, many, many supermarket chains, but three particularly large ones that are, I mean, they're not conventional supermarket chains, they're health food store chains.
Hmm.
And in Spain, there is no countrywide health food store chain. There are regional health food store chains, but there's nothing countrywide. But in France, they have three countrywide health food store chains, which just by the nature that they are dealing with larger markets, you know, from their economic standpoint, can manage to have a greater variety of those kinds of specialty products. So France, you'd be a little better off than Spain.
Thank you. Now, let's just talk about the shopping experience to begin with. In France and Spain, do they have the big supermarkets that we do where you have a one-stop shopping experience, or do they still have the apothecaries and all the little shops where if you want medication, you have to go to an actual pharmacy as opposed to the way that our pharmacies here are mini versions of supermarkets?
Right, right. They both have large mainstream supermarkets. And those do not have pharmacies in them. That's not to say that they won't have, you know, little sections as some of ours do where you can get, you know, toothpaste or shampoo or something. But they very much have pharmacias or apotheques or whatever, you know, the equivalent of drugstores or apothecaries throughout. And in fact, sort of amazingly, all over the place. I mean, in all those France, Spain, Switzerland, Italy, you know, you're sort of, seems like every block. I don't know how they all stay in business. And interestingly enough, those small stores sell not just conventional mainstream products, but they often have right next to them on the shelves herbal products, homeopathic products, all together in the same store. You don't have to seek out a specialty store. There are some specialty stores like special herb shops, really herbal apothecaries, but you can get a number of products, holistic health, alternative health products in the stores that sell conventional medicine products.
Thank you. My next question is, when you are in these stores, especially with the herb salts, where you have the whole selection of herbs, and you know, you're not necessarily looking to cook up a feast, but perhaps you want to just add something in particular to something that you're just quickly trying to make yourself, if you have the amenities to do so at the facility that you're staying at. How does that work exactly? I mean, when you're shopping, what do you advise people to do when they are shopping, especially for fresh foods?
Well, my personal preference is to, if your schedule allows and you're wherever you're traveling, you're there on the right day, is to go to a fresh market. I feel that way in this country as well, but you know, what we would call a farmer's market. And over there, it's called the market. And, you know, these countries, these people have been going to the market. This isn't a trend. You know, it's not a, oh, you know, now we're going to be all in favor of green markets and farmers markets. This is the way these people have shopped for their food for centuries. And the selection at these markets is just phenomenal, not just in terms of fresh produce, but in terms of olives, herbs, cheeses, you know, honey. And not that these markets, you know, not that everything at them is organic. There are some actually markets that specify organic. Most are mixed, so they have both conventionally grown or produced products as well as organic stalls. But that would always be my first choice and first recommendation. And I'll tell you why. Mostly because you get to see this culture of how people shop. And the food that is available on any given, you know, season, it's there, it's fresh, and you can buy just a little bit. You don't have to buy a whole bag of something. You can say, I just want one pepper, or I just want a couple of sprigs of rosemary, or I want a huge bundle of basil because I want to stick my nose in it. Or a beautiful sack of the most perfect peaches, you know, whatever it is. You're speaking to the vendors. You can smell the cheeses. Often they will give you tastes. So if you're uncertain, you know, you can go, oh, what's that one? They'll give you a little taste. I mean, the locals take this very seriously. I remember being at a stall, and this woman, oh, my gosh. She was a local Spaniard, and by gosh, she was going to make sure she got exactly what she wanted. She, you know, was she didn't care that there was a line behind her.
Sounds like me.
There you go. Perfect. So the markets are always the best. And then if it's a situation where you just don't happen to, you know, you're someplace for 3 days and you've missed the market, you know, it happens the day before you arrived or the day after, then the next thing I would recommend is obviously using the information in my books or other information you have to seek out the health food stores, which usually have a lovely array of organic, you know, they're going to specialize in the organic produce as well as other foods. And again, in both France and Spain, but really all the countries in Europe, you just have some beautiful, beautiful foods.
Are there any things that we do here in America that you would not recommend that we do when visiting either Spain or France? For example, I remember when I went to Paris, I had the audacity to put butter on my bread at dinner, and the waiter scolded me as though I committed some sort of criminal offense, and you know, I had no idea what he was so upset about, and he, you know, he made it clear that you just don't do that. And I also learned that you do not ever order Beaujolais Nouveau for dinner. What was I thinking? And you know, just certain things. I mean, I think I alienated most of Paris, but I'm just curious. Are there any things that you've learned that for the Americans that are visiting over there that we should just definitely not do?
Well, you know, there are some things, you know, some basic travel rules. And again, I would say this wouldn't apply just to France and Spain, but, you know, I find it to be most helpful when you're going to a foreign country to really take to heart that old adage, when in Rome, you know, and try to be sensitive, observe, you know, really be in the moment. Traveling is the greatest time to be very present. It's so easy to not be present in our daily lives, just to be really present. You can sit down in a restaurant and just sort of observe what's going on around you. What are people doing, you know, or how are people shopping? You know, people, for the most part, in both France and Spain, but this is pretty true across Europe and certainly the Mediterranean countries, people do not have large refrigerators. people do not do what they do here. They do not do a weekly shop and sort of fill up the back of your car with, you know, 10, you know, overflowing bags of groceries. They go out every day, and some of that has to do with the market mentality, that is the fresh market mentality, but it's a very, very fundamental cultural difference in that in the United States, our food system is geared towards shelf life, and in Europe, it's not. That's not to say that there aren't large supermarkets, but the basic cultural attitude around food is fresh. And so people go out with their market baskets, and they're getting fresh baguettes every day. People do not, you know, store their baguettes for a week. They get them fresh every day. So, you know, what you said about butter, again, remembering that in those countries, cows are not like they are here. They don't have, you know, thousands of acres of land that they can raise cows on, or cattle on, for that matter.
They'd rather raise grapes, make wine.
They would much rather raise grapes. And so dairy, you know, cow dairy products that we're used to, you know, sort of guzzling milk or smearing butter on everything, that is really not done. And certainly in Spain, you know.
Now you tell me.
Yeah. Spain, you know, produces about half the world's olive oil. And that's what they use. They use olive oil on food. They use olive oil on your bread. You know, it's a big deal. There's something like 260 varieties of olives. Who knew, right? Because we think, oh, what's olive oil? You go to the store and there's olive oil.
It's a staple. That's why. I mean, in Spanish cuisine, I mean, the olive oil from Spain is phenomenal.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. The best I've ever had. And what people don't realize is, you know, you can do tastings, which I love to do, because you can, you know, get five bottles of olive oil from Spain, or for that matter, from anywhere, and they're all going to taste a little different. They're all going to have a different quality, and it will depend on what kind of olives were used, but also, you know, where they were grown and when they were harvested and when they were processed and all these things that we don't even think about here. So, you know, definitely, you know, not asking for butter, not asking for things that are not sort of native, you know. I wouldn't ask for a large glass of milk and a pile of butter in a French restaurant.
When I went to Germany, it was interesting. I had the audacity to ask for additional napkins, I think it was. And my sister-in-law practically handed my head to me. She said, you don't do that. And I said, why not? I'm a good tipper. And she said, you just don't do that. It's not part of the culture. And I just couldn't understand what the big deal was. But, you know, after you spend some time in a foreign country and you understand the customs and you know, just how people interact with one another, then it begins to make sense. But, you know, it's always interesting when you travel to a foreign country and you just spend some time observing, and you could see the different mannerisms and just the different exchanges. And, you know, it's really a wonderful experience. It doesn't matter where the country is located, how populated the area is, but just to observe other people living their lives and doing the things that they do on a regular basis. And I think, you know, the more that people interact with one another, they can appreciate how the differences in our cultures are basically what attract us to one another. And if we learned to be open, we can really just have more of a peaceful existence.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that the observing is so important. You know, they also, another very big difference is they don't waste there the same way.
Mm.
So, you know, portions are a little different in terms of, you know, meals if you're eating out. The thing, your story about the napkins makes me think of that, you know, especially in Germany and Switzerland, they're precise culturally. And I'm not making a, like, offensive observation. I admire it tremendously, and obviously some people aren't precise there, but as a rule, culturally, they're precise. They're not going to need a pile of napkins because they wouldn't want to have to do that laundry. They don't, if it's paper, they don't want to waste the paper. They're just not programmed that way, that we really are. And the other thing I just want to point out is you mentioned that about, well, I'm a big tipper, so what's the problem? Even that is a completely different thing, because there, nobody tips 20%. That's not what they do. You tip a little because actually the waiters are paid money. They're not paid whatever they pay here. I don't know what they pay them, $2 an hour or something, because they're supposed to make their money on tips. So even that is different.
They value labor.
Yeah, they value labor. Exactly. Exactly.
It says a lot about how we have been doing things for so many decades and how we really need to strive to change so that we can not only just exist in a way that's beneficial to other human beings, but to all the other beings that we share this planet with.
Now, exactly.
On that note, I need to ask you, this is a very big issue for me when I travel. It doesn't matter where I go, but smoking is a big problem for me. When I went to China, I was the guest of their government, and I told my host that I have severe allergies to smoking. The government officials that I met with, they could not smoke in front of me because they were warned ahead of time about my sensitivities. But now, when you're in Paris, when you're in Spain, it's something that you really need to think about, especially when it comes to your lodging, because there's some places that do permit smoking. And even if you get a room that's not smoking, it has to be, for me, a room has to be non-smoking all the time, not just, oh, well, you know, this is a non-smoking room that we've converted, because I can smell that a mile away.
Right.
And my allergies, I'm too sensitive. So
right.
How do you deal with the smoking subject?
Well, the smoking subject is definitely challenging. In both France and Spain, in the past couple of years, laws have been passed, and this has to do with restaurants, in terms of what is basically not allowed. What happens in both countries is that you can have situations where smoking may not be allowed inside the restaurant, but it's allowed outside, which means if you want to sit outside, you can't. Although those laws have been getting stricter. Now, I must tell you that a few years ago, I had been traveling in both France and Spain, and I had been in France, and it was pretty much right after this law had been passed. And believe it or not, the French were adhering to it. They were. That's not to say people don't smoke on the streets and whatever, but they were abiding by the law. And I come to Spain, and I'm out at a very local Spanish equivalent of a diner, and it's late. I'm with friends. Not late for us, not late for them. It was 11 o'clock at night. That's when a lot of Spaniards eat. And we go into this place, and it is smoky. It is smoky. And I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, I'm trying to be polite here. I've just gotten here. And we're chatting, and I say to my guests and hosts, you know, this is very interesting. I just came from France, and they have this law that you're not allowed to smoke in the restaurants, and they're very compliant, and it's so interesting. So I guess Spain doesn't have the same law. Well, they, all three of them, fell off their chairs howling with laughter. We have the same law, but everybody was smoking.
Dorian, what do you do if you have a situation where you have the sensitivities to smoke and you can't quite find a location that can accommodate you? I mean, are there any resources where you can find lodging that caters to people who have these sensitivities?
In terms of lodging, there are some hotels that really make a point of specifying that they are non-smoking. It is different than in the United States because, as a culture, there are a lot of people who smoke in Europe. But you can find them, and a lot of the accommodations that particularly identify themselves as ecological, eco-accommodations, usually or always non-smoking. And then some of the smaller bed and breakfasts will also identify themselves as non-smoking. But really, the only thing to do is to inquire when you're making your reservations. Now, in Spain, there is a website. It's in the Spain book, and it will let you search for accommodations that have identified specifically as non-smoking. It is not comprehensive, so there are many more that would be included as non-smoking than are listed in that website, but it is a place to start. And as I said, the ones that are considered eco-accommodations are almost always non-smoking.
I actually found the website. It's on page 75 in the Green Earth Guide, Traveling Naturally in Spain. It says, the no-smoking laws in Spain are a little ambiguous. Smoking is allowed in the open air and in bars and restaurants smaller than 100 square meters. Large bars and restaurants can designate a smoking section as large as about a third of their establishment. In many cases, the laws are not enforced. Many natural foods restaurants are non-smoking. And the two links that you provide are www.nofumadores.org. Well, it's a pretty long link.
I know.
But,
maybe we can put that up on the website or something.
Sure. And the other one is www.20minutos.es/locales-sin-humo. And those are two great resources, especially if you have the sensitivity such as I do. It can be a nightmare when you're traveling because if you have a sensitivity and you wind up getting sick, that's a great way to just kill your entire vacation, or if you're there on business, prevent you from enjoying the time that you have there.
Exactly.
Another question that I have for you is in regards to transportation. Transportation can be very, very tricky. Did you find that you might be better off opting for one form of transportation over another? Or, I mean, are there certain forms of transportation that you should just keep away from entirely, like driving in Paris? What do you recommend?
I definitely recommend not driving in Paris. I am myself quite a fan of train travel. In fact, if I had my choice, I would always travel by train. The trains in Europe are, for the most part, delightful. Some are older trains, some are newer trains. They're just wonderful. In France, you have that option. You have bus travel, but buses are more popular in Spain. And Spain is a big country and is a much poorer country than France, even before this recent economic situation that they're dealing with. They've been poor for a long, long time. Not poor in culture, obviously, but just in terms of infrastructure and all their years under the Franco government. And so there are really, you know, vast parts of Spain that do not have infrastructure. Or they might have a train, but it's a very limited train. And so they use bus coach travel a lot in Spain, although they also have been upgrading their train system. And in France, obviously, you can do both. Not only do I prefer trains just as a mode of travel, but I also find that, particularly in France, I had some, in hindsight, humorous, disastrous bus trips. And I say in hindsight because it involved, you know, bus drivers clearly letting me get off in the wrong town and, me then having to hike these 6 kilometers to the next town because there was no other way to get there kind of thing. So, and they are somewhat notorious for that. I mean, I've had locals tell me, oh, yes, you know, I think it's the way they have fun or something. But when you're traveling, it can be pretty disconcerting, especially, and fortunately my case is I was never on some sort of time schedule in those cases where it really messed me up. But with a train, you know, a train makes very specific stops, and they're announced, and it's you could sleep through your stop, but you're not going to intentionally you're not going to get off on the wrong stop intentionally done by the driver of the train. So I prefer train travel. That said, there are some destinations where you have to go by bus, and that's fine as well. I purposely, because my guides are specific to environmental travel, I do not get into traveling by car per se. That said, there are some places where you just need a car. I mean, these are, you know, remote places that if you really want to get around, unless you're going there and then you have access to a bike because you're staying someplace, you know, and you're going to bike into the little village or something, that you do need a car. The good news with that is that for the most part, the cars in Europe are small and energy efficient. And so, you know, you're not going to get a gas guzzler. In fact, you shouldn't get a gas guzzler because in many of these towns in both France and Spain, you have these streets that were, you know, they're ancient. They were designed and built long before the automobile. And you would literally scrape the sides of your car if you were trying to drive in some of these places.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, so the other very practical tip I would tell people is that unlike here, where it's almost impossible to rent a standard shift car, all the cars here are automatic, the reverse is true in Europe. And so if you do not know how to drive a standard shift car, if you do not make prior arrangements, you will end up renting a car that you will not be able to drive, or you will learn very quickly how to drive a standard shift. Automatics are rare. They will cost you a substantial premium on your car rental, and they usually have to be prepared in advance because most places don't even stock them. So that is a little tip that most people don't realize because they just think, oh, I'm renting a car. But if you don't know how to drive a standard shift, you're going to have to make prior arrangements.
When it comes to the actual lodging, one of the things that I've found is, and you know, you tell me if your experience has been the same, when you find a location that is very environmentally friendly, they recycle, they're very aware of different things that they can do as, if you will, a provider of lodging, whether it's a bed and breakfast or a little hotel, what have you, when they are more environmentally friendly, it seems as though the food that they may serve, whether they serve a very, what they call the continental breakfast, which is usually some sort of baked goods, fruit and coffee, tea, what have you, they tend to really push the biological, the organic component as well. And I found that they really do what they can to conserve because, I mean, economically, it also makes sense for them to do that.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. And again, you know, even the ones that aren't, marketing themselves as environmental or, you know, organic establishments, again, just by the nature of their culture for hundreds of years, I mean, you know, water is very expensive in European countries. Electricity is very expensive. Gasoline is very expensive. All the things that we sort of grumble about, oh, you know, gas is so expensive, it's three-something a gallon, you know, it's way more expensive there, and it always has been, and that's why they have efficient cars. And so the same is true for electricity and water. I mean, I've actually lived in some of these countries, and I know, so I've had to pay the bills. I mean, you don't have to use a lot of water in Spain to rack up, you know, a pretty hefty water bill. So by the very nature of the culture, there is your baseline is far more with conservation in mind or efficiency in mind. So then you ratchet that up to a place that is committed to more environmental consciousness in terms of how they're conducting their business and how they're marketing themselves. You're absolutely right. You're going to find that there are a number of things that they do. They're going to serve organic foods or biological foods, as they like to call it, biologique in France. That's what they call organic. So they're going to do that, absolutely.
Thank you. Now, I'd like us to talk about the actual locations and sites that you visited that would be more attractive to someone who is looking to really take pleasure in the natural sites, the forests, the coasts, what have you. Do you have any particular sites that you'd like to mention in both countries so that people that are listening to the show can, listen to what you have to say, and also any other suggestions that you might have in both of the books?
Right. Well, you know, each country, what I found is every country has a bit of their specialty, and it's not to say that the other countries don't share that.
Mm.
In France, you have the whole area of essential oils and perfumery, but sort of leaving that aside because that gets into the realm of synthetics, but in terms of natural essential oils and aromatic herbs, you know, in France you have an enormous lavender growing area in Provence and, quite an industry in terms of all things lavender. And if you happen to be traveling there in July and August, you know, that is just a breathtaking sight to see fields of lavender. If you're there at other times of year, you can still tour the area and, you know, enjoy that, even if you're not seeing the actual blooming lavender. Also in France, you have natural colors. You also in Provence have the area where there's natural ochre, which is a mineral that has been used for literally thousands of years all over the world in art and in painting. And there are still natural ochre sites that you can visit that are tremendous there. You have, in all the countries, you have amazing ancient sites, stone circles, other stone, structures or sites. You have caves. There's a lot of rich history. In Spain, you have, this amazing range of ancient stuff there, as well as particularly in the sort of southern half of Spain, this mixing of the Christian, Jewish, Muslim cultures that coexisted there for a long time. And there are buildings and other structures there, also in both France and Spain, of course, dating back to Roman times, you know, aqueducts and things that are just phenomenal feats, you know, in terms of not just what humans can do, but how humans interact with nature and how people worked with nature rather than conquering it, which I think is a fundamental difference in some of our attitudes today. Switzerland would be the same. Italy would be the same. In all countries, there are long distance walking trails. That is something that is really done in Europe. There are also long distance biking trails. There are also short distance, of course, but you can actually walk from country to country if you were so inclined. You could just do little parts of the trail as a day trip. You could make it your whole holiday. There is a pilgrimage site in Spain, in Santiago de Compostela, in the northwestern part of Spain, and there are routes from all over Europe and Spain, all over Spain, that that go to that spot. And certainly these days some people go as a Christian pilgrimage, but, you know, easily over half of the people that do parts of these trails are not doing it. They're doing it, it's a different kind of pilgrimage. They're doing it either to commune with nature or to just view the countries that they're walking through from foot or bicycle rather than by another form of transport.
Thank you. In regards to entertainment, are there any particular events that go on each week that you care to share with our audience that might take place either seasonally or even weekly or just, you know, frequently that are, you know, fun, they're educational, and they're also, for the most part, free?
Absolutely, you know, and again, sort of coming back to the market, that would be one of them. But there are outdoor films. Of course, this would be seasonal. There are outdoor films. There are all kinds of theater festivals. You know, the Mediterranean countries are very much outdoor oriented, and so much happens both in terms of organized events, you know, and just actually things that you would come upon serendipitously because you're going to sit in the square and have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, and next thing you know, somebody's singing or somebody's juggling or somebody's whatever, doing some fantastic thing that you can't even imagine. So, you know, you're living outside in a way, again, that is not quite the same as what we do here in the United States. But in both Spain and France, certainly, but also true very much in Italy and Greece, you know, these are countries where people live outside, they socialize outside. It's all about being out in the community and being with people, and they're all countries rich with music and dance and festivals. I mean, I don't think a week goes by, at least in Spain, where, you know, there's not something, a fair, a festival. It's either has a religious component to it or not, a seasonal component, you know, and it's sort of an endless possibility of things that you can do in terms of events. And as I said, also in terms of more maybe cultural type things, outdoor film screenings, and all sorts of theater festivals.
And do you recommend that if you're looking to do something that perhaps might be something new, who should you ask? Should you ask the concierge? Should you ask, you know, anybody in particular when you're staying at one of these little inns, what have you?
Well, certainly the people who are running these inns and bed and breakfasts will, you know, be very privy. That's their job to what's going on and when the local events are and what's the best thing to do, and will have, you know, far more than could fit in a book without it being an impractical guide to all sorts of, you know, little special things in their area that are going to be going on. So I would highly recommend speaking to the people. You know, I always like staying in places where you have that more personal connection with the person. I mean, a concierge will, of course, do that if you're in a larger hotel, but, you know, I tend to lean towards these smaller, more bed and breakfast places, some of which maybe don't even speak English that well, but that's, to me, also part of the fun, is you're sort of doing this half a game of charades and half a game of, you know,
showing
pigeon.
Up to China.
Right. And that I love, you know, and it's amazing what you can end up finding. I remember being in Italy and saying to this woman at this inn, I really, really want, you know, a local place for dinner. And she got it. And she said, okay, I'm going to send you where the Italians go. And I said, perfect. And I ended up in this restaurant where, I'm telling you, it was like being in the middle of a film. the tables were in this field. They all had tablecloths, and then what you looked out on was this huge field with sunflowers, and the sun was setting. And you're just thinking, I've died, gone to heaven. This is the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. And, you know, if there was a pasta dish on the menu, there might have been two pasta dishes, but they had all these other sort of interesting, wonderful things that you don't think of necessarily as Italian food as we know it, and it was magnificent.
And I think the fact that you have the opportunity to explore is really what makes it great. And, you know, when in doubt, you can always ask.
You can ask, but again, when we come back to that issue of if you have dietary restrictions, if you have dietary restrictions, you can certainly make use of the information in my guides, but you really, in these countries, you can find, the local food is actually very healthy, and really, you can accommodate pretty much any special dietary need, I would say.
I agree. And so let me ask you, what's next on the agenda? You've done the Green Earth Guide to France, the Green Earth Guide to Traveling Naturally in Spain. What is the next book that we can expect from you?
Well, I have done one to Switzerland, whose specialty would be something like 30,000 miles of walking trails, as well as really a hotbed of fantastic holistic health, natural health venues and spas. So I have done the Swiss book, but I've also moved into the world of apps.
Yeah.
And so I have a green guide to Venice for anybody traveling to Venice, if somebody has not been to Venice, I encourage you to put it on your bucket list. So my latest app is back here in the States. It is looking exclusively at local organic and artisanal foods in Vermont, where I live, of which there are many. I have 500 listings of farms and farm-to-table restaurants, et cetera, where you can find the really bounty of local food here. So I'm going to continue with some other states and possibly some specialty apps somewhat in the vein of what we talked about before the show, June, about, you know, if you're traveling to certain conventions and things, to places where local organic foods are harder to find, working on a specialty app possibly for
that. Can't wait for that. I will be the first in line to get the word out, especially through social media, Dorian.
Terrific, June.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. It has been absolutely wonderful. Can you tell our audience what your website is so that they can connect with you there and also keep up with you on social media?
Absolutely. It's www.travelingnaturally.com. I'm on Facebook as the Green Earth Guides and Green Essential Apps. I'm on Twitter as Traveling Green, and I have a blog, travelingnaturally.blogspot.com.
Thank you so much, Dorian. It has been a pleasure having you on the show today. And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. Please pick up a copy of Dorian Yates' books, The Green Earth Guide, Traveling Naturally in Spain, and Traveling Naturally in France. Two wonderful books, especially if you're looking to make the most out of your time in either country. And also, connect with her on her website, and the apps, they're definitely the way to go, especially if, like me, you try to take advantage of all that your cell phones have to offer. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with the Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon, everyone.